This is Occupied Territory with Mike Fader. And don't forget, after the program and anytime you want, go to our Facebook page. It's kind of a parallel Facebook companion to this radio show. Facebook page is Occupied Territory, and Facebook, Google are two things, and you'll get there. And we continue the conversations we have on the air here, and I post other articles, and we have dialogues between people. Civilized, sometimes uncivilized, but hopefully productive. Today, is our guest on? Okay. Today we have with us Nick Turse, T-U-R-S-E, who's got a new book. And how often do I say this, that you have to buy a book, you know? But this time I'm recommending that you all actually go out and buy this book as soon as you get through listening to this program or order the book. It's called Kill Anything That Moves, The Real American War in Vietnam. And you wouldn't really know about the things in this book that are recounted in this book unless you had been there. And even then, you weren't going to come back mostly and talk about it because it's a great crime and astoundingly shameful. It's basically what the American military did in Vietnam, specifically toward civilians. Hi. You there?
Yes.
Oh, sorry.
I'm sorry. Yeah.
Okay.
The line's a little wonky.
Yeah, it sounds like a rubber band, but we'll do our best. Let me introduce you I'll introduce you just a little bit. Nick Turse is the author of The Complex and managing editor for TomDispatch.com, where you should regularly go to get articles and sign up for their articles, and a fellow at the Nation Institute. What is The Complex?
My first book was The Complex, and it was really an analysis of how the military has infiltrated the civilian sphere in society. I looked at the ways the military had made inroads into sporting events, sponsorships, that type of thing, and also into the video game industry, and just looking at the ways that it had become inextricable from civilian life.
Did you take a look at the merging of drone, drone warfare and video games?
I did, although it was when I was writing that, it was the early days of drone warfare hadn't grown to the level that it is today.
Now this book, "Kill Anything That Moves." Where is that? Where is that phrase from? What is the title from?
Well, it was a phrase that. That I encountered in military records. I first saw this in a particular case file dealing with a veteran, a medic named Jamie Henry, who served in Vietnam in 1967 and 68. And Jamie, I could tell his story in full after, but he was basically his unit came into a small village, and their officer, who was a West Point trained captain, gave an order to kill anything that moves. And the men there proceeded to kill all the civilians in the village, about 20 women and children. And this phrase really, it really stuck in my head. And then I began to notice it as I continued my research. I realized that this was an order that was given the night before the My Lai massacre, where 500 civilians were killed over a period of 4 hours. On March 16, 1968, I realized that the captain involved, the commanding officer, Captain Ernest Medina, had given this order. Then I found it in court-martial records before a Marine Corps massacre, and it seemed that everywhere I looked, I found variations on it. Shoot anything that moves, kill anything that breathes, kill anything that moves, over and over again. And to me, it really became a shorthand for how to understand the war, that this was really a dictum that the U.S. military abided by.
Yeah, I see it when I read the book. It just keeps popping up everywhere, or some version of it. So, how did the research, or how did the book get born? I mean, you're in the National Archives researching something, and one thing leads to another.
Yes, I was a graduate student at the time, and I was working on a project on post-traumatic stress disorder among U.S. Vietnam veterans. And I would go down to the archives on a regular basis and try and find hard records to match up with self-report material, basically what veterans told us about their service. And on one of these trips, I just struck out at every turn. Every research avenue that I pursued was a dead end. And finally, on my last day there, I went to an archivist that I normally worked with, and I told him, look, I can't go back to my boss empty-handed. I need something, at least a lead to go back with, or I'm not going to get back down here. And he thought about it for a moment, and then, he said a couple words that really changed my life. He said, do you think that witnessing war crimes could cause post-traumatic stress? And I said, I think that's an excellent hypothesis. What do you have on war crimes? And he told me that there was a collection of records in the archives basement. They were the records of the Vietnam War Crimes Working Group. And I told him, I'd definitely like to see them. And within an hour, I was paging through report after report, box after box of, to call it a treasure trove of information is the wrong phrase. This was really a horror trove. Mm-hmm. There were hundreds of reports on massacres, murder, assault, torture, mutilation. It was a really horrific record, and I realized pretty quickly that this wasn't in the literature anywhere, that these records had, I eventually found out they'd sat in the archives basement for years without anyone looking at any more than one or two case files.
Well, certainly also.
I realized that this.
I'm sorry, certainly as you point out over and over in the book, it's not anything that's in popular history or that the media ever told anybody at the time or later on. All we ever heard about, and as you mentioned, and the one thing that seemed to catch everything and then get, left behind because it was only one incident, like the single shooter kind of thing, was My Lai. And then all of this stuff was not mentioned at all, right?
That's right. These records were held in the Pentagon in the Army Chief of Staff's office, and they were never made public. The task force that put them together was unofficial. It was kept off the books, and it wasn't designed to spread information about war crimes, even within the military. It wasn't designed to prevent war crimes or create guidance to prevent them in any way or send it out into the field. It was strictly to monitor cases so that the military wasn't caught flat-footed, as it was with My Lai, and whenever possible, to tamp them down. And then these records were simply buried away in the archives.
So are these things online anywhere? Have they disappeared? Do you have copies of them? How did that work?
Well, I was lucky that I had a dissertation advisor when I was in grad school who recommended it and made it possible for me to go down to the National Archives and get a complete set of these records. He was afraid that they would disappear, and I thought that he was actually being paranoid. But sometime after I published my first article on the War Crimes Working Group records, they were pulled from the public shelves, and they've never been publicly available in the same way since. Today, if you want to take a look at these records, you have to file Freedom of Information Act requests for each individual file. But I was lucky to copy the entire collection.
So if anybody really wanted this, the availability of this, I mean, they could contact you ultimately or eventually if they wanted it, right? Or is it classified? What interests me here is that I'm of that generation, of the Vietnam generation, but how old are you?
Oh, I'm 37.
So what brought you to an interest in PTSD and Vietnam veterans and then into this whole subject? I mean, obviously people can be interested in things for all sorts of reasons, but usually things run in generations. You know what I mean? Why were you so drawn to this?
Well, I took that job examining post-traumatic stress disorder basically just as a job. I was doing what was considered sort of mainstream public health history, writing about things like human experimentation in 19th century Hawaii. Ah. But when I started work on the project, I was really fascinated by it, and I was a historian, and I really schooled myself in the Vietnam War. And when I found these records, they really put the hook in me, and I actually tried to get some other Vietnam War historians that I knew to work on them, but everyone was working on a different project or burnt out on the war, and one of them just suggested to me that he thought that these records needed a fresh look by a young historian, which I was at the time when I started this out, and he encouraged me to do it, and I kind of set off on this, and it was a circuitous journey. I began by writing just about these records, and the records took me to Vietnam, and while I was there, I learned that there was a different story that I wanted to tell. These records sort of started me on that path.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, it's like you said before, to use words like, you know, you say treasure trove. I could say I'm glad that you did it, but glad doesn't figure into it. It's important that you did. You did write this book. You know, most people, and the reason, here's a segue from the generational question, which is most people don't, Americans don't get taught history. They don't get taught their own history or their international participation either. So Americans are essentially ignorant about their own history, either internally or externally. So maybe real quick, you could give people a little bit of a history. What I was fascinated by, for instance, was that the Vietnamese, and you can expand on this a little bit, had really been aiding the Americans, and when the Americans were, you know, in the Far Eastern War against the Japanese in World War II, and that Ho Chi Minh and the Viet Minh at the time, later on when they wanted to declare their own, you know, free country, it was a French colonial place, they actually used the very words or paraphrased the words of the Declaration of Independence, and they may have actually expected the Americans to help them. Is this all, you know...
That's right. You know, Ho Chi Minh was well traveled, and he had he'd spent time in America, and he'd studied the American political system, and you know, he was very taken with it. Although, you know, he was a representative who went to speak on behalf of the Vietnamese during the Versailles peace talks after World War I. Mm-hmm. And he heard President Wilson, the American president there, talk about self-determination for peoples. And he really thought that this might apply to the Vietnamese, who were under French colonial rule at the time. But Wilson was really referring to white people in Europe, and not to Asians. Mm-hmm. So Ho Chi Minh was a little put off by this, but not so much that you know, during World War.
Yeah, we're having a little trouble with the connection.
Since Vietnam.
Yeah. Go ahead. I don't know. Is that? We're gonna have to call our guest back. Maybe it's a mobile phone. Maybe it's maybe he is in transit or something. But you know, it's fascinating to me. In the modern world, everybody is theoretically connected to everybody else. Everybody's got one phone, two phones, three phones. They got their computer. They got Skype. And yet, there is more difficulty in speaking to people. From my experience, it used to be if everybody had a, you know, I'm like, I don't want to do this whole back in the day crap. I know you hate that, but. Usually everybody once had, like, they had a landline, right? That was it. So if the phone rang and somebody was there, they picked it up and you spoke to them, no problem. If they weren't there, they didn't pick it up. This is even before answering machines. So now everybody's in touch with everybody else theoretically, but actually much worse actually. So that's a good sentence, right? So we're trying for our guests again. So the essential point here about the history of Vietnam is originally they were, you know, like everybody else in Southeast Asia, they had to deal with the Chinese Empire going back hundreds of years, maybe 1,000 years. And, you know, to preserve their own borders or what semblance of a country they had, tribal though it may have been. And then the French come in the middle of the 1800s, in the middle of the 19th century. And, you know, it's colonial rule, the same as everywhere else. Brutal, nasty, violent. Rape, torture, basically serfdom almost, like practically like slavery. And then creating these vast rubber plantations and other plantations there. And the French, you know, sort of owned the place the way the British owned India and ran it. And this was colonial rule of the worst. So the French were actually worse than the British. And then along come the Japanese and chase everybody away, right? They were initially very successful in Southeast Asia. And the Vietnamese, of course, find somebody else they have to fight. First it's the Chinese, then it's First it's the Chinese, then it's the French they have to deal with, and then more invaders. People keep invading them, right? Then the Japanese invade them. And after World War II, you know, the French are reestablished as the, you know, Ho Chi Minh's, you know, hopes about the freedom and the equality and the justice that he learned in the United States, or that he thought he learned, were all vaporized because the United States did not help at all. And the French immediately took back their colonial possessions with their secret police, with their army, with their puppet governments. And then Ho Chi Minh had no alternative but to, you know, declare war, an insurrection, a civil, you know, a revolutionary war. People forgot in those days. Oh, hi, Nick, you're back.
Yes.
Yeah, I've been. modern communications are really a joy. I was just sort of summing up the history, but you know, talking about the Chinese Empire originally, then dealing with the French colonials in the 19th century, then World War II, the Japanese. I mean, these people are constantly being, in you know, invaded, oppressed in one way or another by one group or another, and then. They had a reason to expect after they helped the Americans, and maybe Ho Chi Minh had observed this democracy in action, or heard the words anyhow, that after World War II, after all this effort for all that had been going on, that the United States would favor their declaration of a free Vietnam. But America was more allied to France, and they felt that its political interests were more for France and for other political reasons, to stop the spread of communism, the original evil empire. They just sided completely with the French, right? And then in 1954, when the French were finally defeated, more or less severely, you know, by the Viet Minh, the Americans just took over. The Dulles brothers just said, "We got to have this place," and that's how that's where we're at then, right? Vietnam.
That's right. You know, Vietnam was sort of it was divided into two placeholder regions, and there was supposed to be a reunification election in 1956. But you know, the U.S. knew that Ho Chi Minh, who was now the head of the Communist Democratic Republic of Vietnam in the north, was sure to sweep any nationwide vote. So the U.S. just picked off where its French partners had left off, and you know, it launched efforts to thwart reunification and started arming its allies in the southern part of the country.
One of the best books I've ever read about Vietnam, which gives a good history of it too, and continues throughout the whole war, is A Bright Shining Lie. You know, the story about John Paul Vann.
Yes, Neil Sheehan's book. It's a real classic on the war.
Terrific book. So the essential, the focus of this book is people know about what they do know from whatever they know from literature or from whatever came out finally, history books, is that the American fought a war with the Viet Cong, with the North Vietnamese troops, and with maybe various other brands of soldier in Vietnam. But what they don't know at all, and what this book brings out in the most horrible, overwhelming detail, but it needs to be done, is the way the American Army treated not just the soldiers they were fighting with, or the guerrilla warfare that they had to deal with, but the civilians of Vietnam. That seems to be the focus of the book, right?
Yeah, you know, there are 30,000 books out there on the Vietnam War, and many of them very good, but there are none that I found that really attempted to tell the complete story of what I ended up seeing as a signature aspect of the conflict, which is Vietnamese civilian suffering. I mean, millions of Vietnamese were killed or wounded or made refugees due to deliberate U.S. policies, like the use of almost unrestrained bombing and artillery shelling across wide swaths of the countryside. So these were deliberate policies that were dictated at the highest levels of the military, and it created a veritable system of suffering. And what that meant for the Vietnamese people is what my book is really meant to explain.
When I read the figures, it was difficult. I had to keep reading them over and over again, you know, because it was really hard to digest. I was trying to adjust for how it would be, let's say, in this country. You're talking about a country of around 19 million people, I think you said, and close to 7 million people out of 19 million people either were wounded, were damaged physically or mentally in some way, or killed. Now, that's more than a third of the population. If it was in this country at that time, what the population was, it would have been something like 90 million people.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, like you said, there are 2 million civilian dead is the best estimate we have. Of course, we'll never know for sure. 5.3 million civilian wounded, around 11 million Vietnamese made refugees, 4 million exposed to toxic defoliants like Agent Orange. So it's really suffering on an unimaginable scale, or at least it was unimaginable to me, even after I'd done significant research on the topic. And, it was really only after I first reported from Vietnam that I really began to understand the scale of the suffering. Even the numbers, didn't drive it home in a way that I really began to grasp it when I started talking to Vietnamese about it.
You know, there are the way that the American Army went about and the American military government, you know, like the heads of the Army and the actual troops in the field went about accomplishing this horrible crime, you lay out in detail in the book, and then there are many, many, many testimonies and descriptions by you and reports that you had from soldiers that are very hard to read. I mean, this is not the kind of book that you want to just sit down and read like before bedtime or something like that. This is a sad, awful book and a story that needs to be told. So there's graphic descriptions of rapes, of murders, of the worst kind of torture. But there were two things that sort of stand out for me. One is, and you mentioned these, of course, in the book, is, by the way, if you just tuned in, we're talking to Nick Turse, T-U-R-S-E, and the new book is called Kill Anything That Moves, The Real American War in Vietnam. And two things stand out for me is the behavior of the American military there based on a kind of complete and utter racism, you know, gooks and everything else, and you can expand on that. And the other thing is that McNamara, who had worked during World War II to increase efficiency of, I don't know what it was, bombing of American military tactics in World War II, he was in charge of all this, the Defense Secretary McNamara, and he brought a corporate, what he hoped was a corporate efficiency to war. And the idea of body counts, which is what you talk about over and over again, that he wanted to see results like any kind of business or a corporation would want to see from one of its branch, from one of its one of its licensees would like to see results, you know, a good bottom line. And the bottom line of Vietnam for this business McNamara had of killing people was body counts, right?
That's right. As you mentioned, McNamara served during World War II. He worked on systematizing bombing of Japanese cities. And then after the war, he went to work at Ford Motor Company, and he ran it for 10 years until he was called back to government service by John F. Kennedy. And he served as Secretary of Defense from 1961 to 1968. And he really saw, he believed the Pentagon could be run as a business by the same principles, and that war could be made rational. You know, the idea was that war would be run in a rational way, and they settled on the attrition strategy, which was basically the idea behind it was to kill more Vietnamese than they could put into the field. And eventually, the enemy would also look at war in the same rational, technocratic manner that McNamara did, mm-hmm. and they would see more debits than credits on their ledger sheet, and they would just give up the fight.
In other words, it wouldn't be good business for them to continue.
That's right. He thought everyone would see the world the way he did. Of course, the Vietnamese saw this as a nationalist struggle, a continuation of their anti-colonial struggle, and a fight for their freedom. So they weren't looking at it as a business. But McNamara could never wrap his head around this. And because of that, and because of the fact the U.S. wasn't facing off against a World War I type war, army on army, mm-hmm. we're fighting a guerrilla conflict. They weren't trying to take territory. They weren't trying to capture an enemy capital. They had to find a metric to show that they were winning the war, and they settled on the idea of body count. Basically, you would kill your way to victory by piling up Vietnamese bodies. The problem with this was that troops in the field recognized rather quickly that their commanders were, in many cases, obsessed with bodies, but they didn't care who those bodies belonged to.
They had to report them as enemy soldiers, combatants, right?
That's right. But their commanders didn't really care that they wouldn't be able to turn in weapons alongside these bodies. Mm-hmm. We've mentioned the My Lai massacre, a few minutes ago. At My Lai, 500 civilians were killed. But when it was reported to the world, it was a victory over 128 armed enemies.
It's interesting you mention that because, I come from that generation, and when you mentioned that number, the second number, what was it, 128? That's the number I remember from news reports at the time of civilians finally that were killed. In other words, the two things got blended in my mind because of the media reports, and that's what I remember is the number being killed. And I was surprised to read in your book how many more it was.
Yeah, 504 civilians died at My Lai, according to the Vietnamese monument. The U.S. never settled on a number. They said somewhere between 347 and upwards of 450, depending on which report that you read. But you know, the Vietnamese fixed it at more than 500. But the official records show a victory of over 128 enemies killed. But the U.S. didn't lose any lives that day in My Lai, even though they're supposedly fighting a hardcore Viet Cong unit, and they only collected three weapons for their day's work.
Well, I remember
the numbers were radically skewed.
And just like any business, if they're looking at it that way, if you have people who are working their way up in a business, like, you know, officers who want to be promoted, like in a business, if you want to make the head of your division or the head of this or the head of the department, you have to show more results. And soldiers in the field also, as you mentioned, which is astounding to me, but you could explain it, they were rewarded for the more bodies they reported, correct?
That's right. They had positive and negative reinforcement. If you didn't turn in the bodies, you'd be kept out in the field. So you were courting exhaustion and a greater chance of being killed or wounded. But if you turned in a body, there were all sorts of rewards depending on the unit. Sometimes they were given 3-day passes. Any kill would get you 3 days at a beach resort in Vung Cao, the Americans' beach resort in Vietnam. Or you get extra beer, or better food, or light duty when you're back at base camp, or badges, medals, special non-regulation gear to wear, all these sorts of incentives. So they really, they put the system into motion. One of the veterans that I talked to, he called it an incentivizing of death, and he said that that it really, you know, messed with their value system. That this. You know, a lot of members of the unit were just, desperate to get a body count to get out of the field. Mm. And their officers weren't discerning about which bodies were turned in.
And as far as the officers go, like in any business, as I was mentioning before, McNamara's running a business, you want to rise, to be the head of your department and the head of a division or vice president, in this case, captain, major, whatever, colonel, general, you have to also have your troops show a lot of body counts in your area, right?
That's right. A lower-level officer generally got about 6 months' time in the field, so you had just a brief amount of time to prove your worth and get promoted. So you didn't have much time. You had to show results fast. And you had the guy above you, your commander, breathing down your neck. You know, he's looking to move ahead, so he's going to put pressure on you. And, it just went all the way, up and down the line. This was the way that the war was fought.
Now, there are the various ways, and you almost break them down by chapter or by sections of chapters, and the ways in which these body counts were piled up, and it's mostly civilians. There are several different ways, and I jotted them down here. One was, first of all, murder of prisoners and sheer murder of prisoners and civilians, right?
That's right. A lot of times you'd have a commander who was demanding a body count. Even if you had a prisoner, they wanted a body. So, I recount circumstances in my book where, Vietnamese enemy prisoners or even just civilian detainees with their hands down were just executed in cold blood so they could be called in as an enemy kill.
The other thing is also you mentioned the torture of prisoners. I mean, one of the reasons that history books are important, which you're a historian, is that it's based on that old adage, if you don't study history, then you're doomed to repeat it. And obviously we are repeating it over and over again, Iraq, Afghanistan, torture, all of this stuff. But it all happened in Vietnam there, right?
It did. The anecdotal record of torture in Vietnam paints a really disturbing picture. Torture was an everyday fact of life throughout a very vast prison system that the U.S. built for its Vietnamese allies, somewhere around 500 different detention centers around the country, where torture was basically the order of the day. But, I looked into these U.S. records, and there is, there are spot reports of different torture use of torture among units, but I did find one comprehensive study. The military kind of stumbled into an investigation. They thought they were investigating one or two instances of torture, and what they found when they looked at this one military intelligence unit was torture on a systematic scale over, they looked at a period of 22 months and over that time period, it showed that torture was just a regular course of action every day.
Well, also, they were instructed. The American troops were often instructed to turn over prisoners or other South Vietnamese to the South Vietnamese troops, right?
That's right. There are veterans who talk about being told that you don't have to torture them yourself. You just turn it over them over to your Vietnamese counterpart, and they'll do the job for you. Mm-hmm. And in some circumstances, this was the case. But the investigation files I found showed that that the Americans utilized torture on a regular basis as well. Things like water torture, which now we know is waterboarding, electrical torture, where they used what was called a field telephone. Basically, it was a telephone with a crank on it and two wire leads, and they would attach these leads to a person's fingers or nipples or genitals and crank the phone and just dispense electric shocks. So this was a fact of life in Vietnam.
And what about free fire zones? Can you tell people what free fire zones are?
Sure. This was sort of a legalistic term that the U.S. military dreamed up to sort of legitimize opening up the country to unrestrained fire. Basically, they would declare an area to be a free fire zone, and anyone in it would be then fair game. They would either fly over an area in a helicopter or airplane with a loudspeaker that would make an announcement that people on the ground might or might not hear, or they would drop leaflets down on a largely illiterate peasant population that would tell them they had a certain amount of time before bombs would start falling. And the idea was to drive the Vietnamese from the countryside to break their bond with the revolution, with the guerrillas. Unfortunately, the only place the Vietnamese had to go were either extremely squalid slums that began to spring up around Vietnam cities or towns, or equally bleak concentration zones or refugee centers.
Mm-hmm.
And even Vietnamese Vietnamese people are very tied to their land, so they weren't apt to go. But sometimes they were bombed out of the countryside and into these places. But generally, the privation there was so great. They didn't have enough food, enough water, that they would eventually just head back into the free fire zone. They found this preferable to what they encountered in the refugee camp. But, it made life hell for the Vietnamese people.
So they
should be living in an area that was open to unrestrained fire.
This is artillery fire, B-52 bombs, everything, right?
Everything. They could really open up on this area with everything in the U.S. arsenal. So it was high explosive artillery, incendiary agents like white phosphorus and napalm, high explosives from B-52s and from fighter bombers, and helicopter gunships could just hunt in this area and basically shoot at anything that moved.
And they did shoot at anything that moved. So there's numerous instances in your book, again, very difficult to read and to understand that actually happened, but just shooting people off bicycles, shooting farmers in the field, whatever, right?
That's right. And, the U.S. would, troops would often come up with all sorts of fictions or they'd be passed down from their commanders. A lot of times people were shot for taking evasive action. But that basically meant that anyone running could be shot, and troops were told that it was okay to do this. If they're running, they must be Viet Cong guerrillas. But of course, a lot of times these were just people who were working in their fields, and a helicopter would hover over them for a long period of time, and eventually they'd get too frightened, or a helicopter would start firing its machine gun near them, and they felt they had no other choice. They would run, and they'd be cut down by American fire.
What there's a term that's been in use for a long time. I don't know, maybe it's gone out of use, but there was a term that was around for decades, and it started in the Vietnam War called overkill. What is that?
Well, overkill really came out of America's nuclear program, nuclear studies.
Ah, okay.
The phrase comes out of that. But I used it as a shorthand because, in a lot of revisionist histories of the war, they talk about the American military is fighting with one hand tied behind its back, and as if if it could have been freed, the U.S. could have won the war.
Yeah, we used to hear that all the time. During the time when I was out on the streets protesting and dealing with the cops in New York City, but we used to hear this stuff all the time from people who told us that we were, you know, communists or whatever, that that we lost the war for America. In other words, American protesters lost the war because if they had only been allowed to do what they really wanted to do, as bad as it was, and as you point out in your book, they didn't do as much as they really wanted to do over there because they could have won if they did, right?
Well, that's always been a contention. But really, I mean, the only things America really unleashed its entire arsenal on Vietnam and most of it on South Vietnam, its ally. You know, other than nuclear weapons, which were really politically untenable, that wasn't really a possibility, or a full-scale invasion of North Vietnam, which would have taken millions of troops on the ground, and you know, Johnson or Nixon would have been able to do this. You know, that they were having enough problems filling the military roles. They couldn't have gotten the manpower necessary. So other than that, there really wasn't anything else that was left at their disposal. They really unleashed everything in the arsenal, and South Vietnam was hit by more ordnance than was dropped by all sides during World War II. So there really wasn't much more that the U.S. could have done to blanket Vietnam with heavy firepower.
I guess part of what they meant was that if we hadn't slowed, if we hadn't gotten public opinion so finally arrayed against the government and outraged by what they were doing, then they could have stayed there long enough, you know, like a la Afghanistan, which, of course, is a disaster and a failure. It doesn't matter anyhow. But if they had stayed there longer and bombed even more, or, you know, maybe they thought, I don't know what they thought. But part of the thing here is, and you mentioned in your book, and it's obvious, is, and we had an experience in the Philippines, the Americans' first, I guess, experience in the Far East, in the Philippines, was somewhat similar to Vietnam, and especially the way we treated the countryside and the people there, you know, starting in 1898 and all through, let's say, the early 1900s. Basically, the same thing that we did to those people over there and the way we acted and the way American troops acted, and in terms also, there were plenty of rapes that went on. You mentioned frequent rapes, uncontrolled, out-of-control behavior, rapes, and just plain murders. But that kind of thing is based on a kind of racism, it seems to me. I mean, people, they were told to call them gooks and dinks and everything. It could never have happened, in other words, in Germany, you know, that kind of thing.
I think that's right. You know, there really is a two-tiered system of American warfare when you look back at the U.S. military history, that there's one type of war that's pursued against white foes and another type against what you might call racial others, you know. Mm-hmm. Racially dissimilar peoples, and the phrase that you mentioned, "gook." I mean, there was a this acronym used in Vietnam, the MGR, or the Mere Gook Rule, and the idea was that the Vietnamese weren't real people; that they were subhuman, mere gooks who could be killed or abused at will. And you know, even this phrase of "gook," it comes out of the Philippines insurrection experience. The war that you mentioned, they called the Filipinos then "gugus," and this transmuted into "gook." And when the Marines went and carried out small wars in Nicaragua and Haiti at the beginning of the 20th century, they called the people there "gooks." And when the U.S. fought in Korea mid 20th century, they called the Koreans "gooks." And then they revived the term in Vietnam. And this racism really suffused the training of American troops who went to Vietnam. I talked to many veterans who told me that as soon as they got to boot camp, to basic training, they were told, don't ever call them Vietnamese. You call them gooks or dinks, slamps, slopes, anything that took away their humanity. And this dehumanization made it easier to kill the Vietnamese and view any Vietnamese as enemies.
This sounds I've read a lot of history, and especially history of World War II. This sounds so extraordinarily similar to what the Nazis did in terms of the way they looked at people and how they trained their soldiers.
Yeah, it's the very same type of principle. I mean, it's a form of dehumanization, and a lot of nations use it. I mean, it's not just Nazis or the United States. When you're fighting a racially dissimilar foe, this is something that a lot of nations employ because it's very basic and visceral, and a way to get men, or in the case of those that fought Vietnam, basically these were American boys, 18, 19, 20 years old, to really revile the enemy.
Another thing, since you just mentioned that, another thing is that you, speaking of these teenagers that were sent over, and people should not forget that there was a draft then, too. And people, this was our version of a press gang in a way. Now we have a volunteer army, and that's a whole other thing. But in those days, anybody could be drafted, you know, unless you went to a whole lot of trouble to get out or you were truly medically or psychologically unfit. You would be drafted from, you know, like 18, 19, 20, 21, 22, 23, anything like that. You get drafted and get sent right over there. They didn't have a lot of happy people going over there, people who were joining to fight the evil Nazis. And they weren't. There was no education. They didn't know who they were fighting. They didn't know where they were. They didn't know what the point of it was. And they're over there drafted, a lot of them against their will. And what you're going to get is a lot of outrage and a lot of resentment. And then they give you a gun and say, here, here's something you can do about all that bad feeling, right?
Well, the U.S. troops who went to Vietnam were surprisingly, I mean, maybe not surprisingly, ill-trained for the experience. Basically, as I mentioned, there was this racist component. They were also told that, all Vietnamese were potential enemies, that women, could be building booby traps, that children might have grenades, that it was safer to shoot first, basically because no one would ask questions later. So they were really told to see all Vietnamese as the enemy, even though they were supposed to be going to Vietnam to protect the Vietnamese people from supposed outside aggression, North Vietnamese aggression. And they were given really no training about how to fight, a guerrilla conflict in the midst of a civilian population. They were sent into a countryside where basically everyone wore what the Americans called black pajamas, which is a black loose-fitting clothing that the guerrillas wore, but also the farmers wore. And basically they were told that, anyone in black pajamas is the enemy. So this, they weren't given any kind of decent guidance, and they were really just thrown into what was often an extremely untenable situation where they could never quite see their foe. They'd be attacked through snipers and booby traps and ambushes, and often they'd be angry and frustrated, and the only Vietnamese that they would find would be civilians, women and children in a village. And often that's where they took out their frustrations on those people.
But their commanders knew. I mean, these guys graduated from West Point. They were captains. They were majors, colonels, generals. These people, Westmoreland, all the way up to the top, they knew about the Geneva Convention. They knew about standard rules of engagement. Did they not instruct people and have it trickle down?
Well, the instruction that was given out was really pro forma, and it was lackluster, about an hour on the Geneva Conventions, and most time was spent on what you were, as the soldier, were supposed to do if you were captured, which is basically give your name, rank, and serial number. So, while these existed on paper and while troops were given a card that had information on what to do with prisoners and how the civilian population should be well-treated, these were, some sort of, methods that were used to paper over and create a paper trail for the command to show that they were, abiding by the letter of the law. But what the troops were told was something radically different, that wasn't represented in these rules on paper or an hour-long lecture, once during boot camp.
The last thing before we move on to maybe one or two final things, which are sort of larger issues, is there was a sort of a plague of rapes that went on. I mean, this had nothing to do, obviously, with, saving or protecting any particular population. And there was a widespread rape. And then they burned everything down all the time. They burned down thousands and thousands of villages down there. So what about burning them all down? What about these rapes? I mean, what's that got to do with subduing the enemy?
Well, sexual warfare is an ancient type of warfare, and it's been pursued to try and break civilian populations. In Vietnam, what went on was ad hoc, but you had an angry, a lot of angry young men out there in the field. And, again, a lot of them took their frustrations out on the only Vietnamese that they found, and these were women. We don't have like most war crimes, these were covered up. So trying to figure out how many rapes went on in Vietnam is impossible. But the anecdotal record we have is really frightening. And I recount in the book just some, astonishingly brutal gang rapes, things like that, that were carried out. This is, You know, it was you know, something almost beyond rape. You know, I a lot of times I felt I didn't have the language to talk about exactly what was going on, but I tried to spell out these cases from the records as fully as I could. And in regards to burning, this was again the way that the Americans tried to break the ties between rural Vietnamese and the guerrillas and the revolutionary movement. The idea was to just burn them out of the countryside. So, you know, when I went to Vietnam and talked to people, they would tell me about their home being burned down sometimes 3, 4, 5, 6 times during the war. You know, this was a regular occasion. American patrols would come through and set everything on fire. The Vietnamese would rebuild and rebuild, and eventually, generally, they would give up and began living in their bomb shelters for so they could live a semi-subterranean life.
And then the bomb shelters were considered, you know, hideouts for the Viet Cong, and they were and they tossed grenades in there, or you know, that kind of thing. So there's no way that they could win at all, right?
That's right. They were really left with no place to turn. You know, the Americans saw these as enemy bunkers and would generally just grenade them. So the Vietnamese were always making calculations when to come out of the bunker, when not to. And your life and the life of your entire family could hinge on this calculus that just went on every day of the war for 10 years for a lot of people.
So these things we see, like, you know, if you look at these movies and people at least, you know, if they don't read history books, which people tend not to do in this country, and if they see a movie like Platoon, or is it Casualties of War? Is that the name of it? Yeah. If they see Platoon or Casualties of War or Apocalypse Now, what you're looking at is things that happened almost on a routine basis over there, right?
Well, these movies do give you, you know, a glimpse of what it was like for the Vietnamese. They're always kind of you know, minor characters because the movies obviously they focus on Americans, but you can get a glimpse at the horrors of the war. Casualties of War is a movie from the 80s about the kidnap and gang rape of a woman. That with that movie, there's at least a Vietnamese at the center of the story. And the others in Platoon and Apocalypse Now, you do see this cruelty towards the Vietnamese on the periphery and attacks on villages. So you see a little bit there. It exists in the popular culture, but it's almost never front and center.
Well, one of the last two questions I have here, and I appreciate your staying on for so long, but this is an important thing. Next to last question here. We didn't hear about all this except for rare cases during the war. You know, I was in my 20s during the war. You didn't hear about this. It wasn't reported in the newspapers. It wasn't on TV until way later when it became sort of the popular thing to report on because most Americans were turning against it because of the draft. And people started seeing people coming home in body bags and people were crazy when they came home. But you didn't really hear about it. I was lucky to be involved with one of the few places that actually made a big issue of it and sent our own reporter illegally to North Vietnam, and that was the Pacifica Foundation, WBAI in New York, radio station. But otherwise, you never heard about this. So naturally, of course, if you didn't hear about it, it wasn't happening. So question is, what kind of responsibility do you ascribe this? I guess by now it's become a rhetorical question. What was the responsibility and the behavior of the press and the media in those days?
Well, I mean, at the time, you know, I should say there were people in Vietnam. There are hundreds of reporters, and even before My Lai, you know, there was one group that counted 3,000 articles in mainstream publications that dealt with U.S. violations of the laws of war.
Oh, so it was being reported.
Well, it was being reported, but the problem was there was no context. They would talk about, you know, torture going on, but they wouldn't say that it was torture. They would describe an act, but they wouldn't say it was torture. They wouldn't say this was something that Japanese war criminals were imprisoned or hung for doing to Americans during World War II, that type of thing. So it was in the literature, but it was under the radar in some ways because, you know, it wasn't pointed out as a war crime. It's just pointed out as, you know, this is the way that wars are fought. You know, war is hell, that type of thing. Then My Lai came around, and, you know, there was a great focus on it. And then after that, there was some focus on war crimes. But the press kind of quickly moved away from that because, you know, the Vietnam War started winding down. You know, stories about atrocities, a lot of editors felt they'd heard it before because they'd already reported me lie.
Mm-hmm.
And almost as quickly as it sprang up as an issue, it started to fade away.
Go ahead.
One of the most telling things about the nature of reporting in Vietnam is that the signature war crime that we know about, My Lai, wasn't broken by one of the 500 reporters that were in Vietnam at the time. It was broken by a stateside reporter named Seymour Hersh.
Mm-hmm.
So even though there were lots of reporters there, a lot of times they weren't able to get the story. And when they did, a lot of times it was sort of buried in the paper and people didn't recognize it as a war crime.
And that was back in the day when you could actually go out in the field or get around the military somehow. But, you know, it wasn't when the military started embedding, I hate that word, when they started embedding the press and when the press was kept strictly out of a country during the first invasion of Iraq and then in Afghanistan, the press doesn't get to go where they want to go. The military tells them what they need to hear now. But in those days, people could do it. We're near the end of the hour here. And I wanted to ask you, this is an inevitable question. So how high did this knowledge go about these incredible crimes that were being committed on a regular basis, of these millions of deaths and woundings and rapes and everything else that were going on and massacres? I mean, how high did it go? Did all the generals know about it? How did it go up to the State Department, to the Defense Department, to the president?
Well, you know, the president was appraised of the work of the Vietnam War Crimes Working Group. This was Nixon when this was instituted, so there was a knowledge of all these war crimes cases that the public was never told about, but the White House certainly knew. And, you know, of course, all these policies that we've been talking about, they were promulgated from the top levels of the Pentagon. The top generals couldn't help but know what was going on in Vietnam. So, I mean, really, this was command policy coming down from the top. So, mm-hmm. And the military is well aware, I mean, that it was inevitable that large numbers of civilians would be killed. No secret to that.
In the book, you mentioned certain people, and I guess we don't have time to go into it now, but you mentioned certain people who were heroic in the midst of all this, and it's good that you mentioned them in their stories. Jamie Henry is one. And then you mentioned some of the worst criminals, which is one of them wound up being a colonel and even a general later on. So there's those details. But basically, there was almost no punishment for all these thousands and tens of thousands of awful crimes. There's almost been no punishment to all these people, right?
That's right. The record of action against any of these alleged war criminals is it's startlingly low. Of the hundreds of cases in this War Crimes Working Group collection, there are very few convictions at court-martial for any crimes. And even, just to give one example, I mean, the most severe punishment handed down was a 20-year sentence for a military interrogator who raped a young girl. But even though he was sentenced to 20 years, he served somewhere around 7 months before he was released.
And one of the lieutenants in charge at My Lai was Lieutenant Cali, and he was put under house arrest and then released not too soon afterwards, right?
Yeah, I mean, he served really only months of confinement, and it was under house arrest, so he was in his own quarters, and then he was pardoned by Richard Nixon. So he got off scot-free.
So here's the last question. We only have like 2 minutes. Why do we all need to read about this now? What is it that we can learn from this, and what is it we can do about having this knowledge?
Well, I think that since America is really involved in military conflicts abroad, almost constantly now, Afghanistan, Iraq, Pakistan, Libya, Yemen, Somalia, it's really important that Americans understand what war is really like, especially for people who live with war every day, that's civilians overseas. You know, the wars that we're fighting today, they cause immense suffering, but the stories of civilians affected by America's wars rarely make the front pages of newspapers or lead the nightly news. And I think it's Americans are called upon to send their brothers and sisters and sons and daughters to war. They ought to have a clear idea of what that war means for the sons and daughters of people overseas.
So this is showing what the effect is of our behavior, which is something Americans never seem to have wanted to take account of or to take responsibility for. So that's really one of the essential things about this book that's important is what it's like, what it was like from the other side, what it is like from the other side. The book is Kill Anything That Moves, The Real American War in Vietnam, Nick Terse. And buy the book and lend it to everybody you know and give it to people who you think might not even like to read it or people who believe in these wars right now. It's something they need to know about who we are and what we've done and what we're doing now. I really appreciate your sticking around for so long. Thank you.
Thanks very much for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Okay. Nick Terse. What do you have, about a minute left there? Okay. Go to Occupied Territory, and if you've heard this interview, you can comment on it. Go to the Facebook page, Occupied Territory. Now we don't put troops in the field like that so much, and we won't anymore. We're using all these remote control bombers and drone missiles, drone bombers, drone strikes. And in some ways, that's even worse. It's even worse because it's more impersonal. And the United States government, not you and me, but the United States government, specifically the president and his private army and people in the CIA, can kill people all over the world. We won't know about it, and we won't care about it because no troops will come home in body bags, and it's clean, and it's no problem, and there's no sense of responsibility. It's the most insane way that people have ever killed people in the history of human warfare, and it's going to make all of us sick. The whole culture will be sicker than it is even now because we won't pay with our bodies for the crimes we commit overseas. Somebody will just press a button and no one will even know about it. All right, we'll be back next week.